Hello and welcome to At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not-so-old. I'm Richard Davis, and I hope you'll stay with me for the next hour. During that time, we'll be finding out about the Sussex Biodiversity Records Centre, which has just achieved its 7 millionth record. Catherine Stead of the Brighton and Hove Philharmonic Society will be previewing the second half of the Society's series of Sunday afternoon orchestral concerts at the Dome. And Chris English will be reviewing Abigail's Party, which he saw at the Theatre Royal just recently. As usual, we'll be giving out various email addresses, website addresses and telephone numbers during the course of the programme, so you may like to have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write them down. So let's get started with finding out about the Sussex Biodiversity Records Centre. Back in November, I went over to Woodsmill, where I talked to Bob Foreman, and I began by asking him what exactly is the Records Centre.
Ah, now there's a question. We are a department of the Sussex Wildlife Trust, but we're slightly a ring-fenced department because of the fact that we are funded differently to the rest of the Wildlife Trust, because we're not a charitable organisation, but we're hosted by the Wildlife Trust, and our role is to be the repository, if you like, of the biodiversity information across the whole of Sussex. We keep a database of species records that is collected by volunteer recorders and consultant ecologists. We've got a very, very comprehensive species database, as well as records of habitat types and land use types. So effectively, all environmental information for Sussex.
So how are you funded, actually?
We're a partnership organisation, and our partners include all the district councils and county councils, as well as non-governmental organisations and charities such as the National Trust and the Environment Agency. And the Sussex Wildlife Trust itself is one of our partners, of course. And through that partnership, we collate their data and provide it back to them in whatever way they want it. We give them updates on the species data that we receive, and they can come to us for various reports whenever they like as well. That's our main source of funding, but we also do project work, and that's a more sort of involved data analysis. Those are two sides to it, and of course the very important one is we produce biodiversity data reports for sites, for ecological consultancies and various other organisations. And because the data isn't actually ours, we don't charge for the data, but we charge a fee for the service of producing the report. And so therefore, you know, quite a considerable amount of our income comes from the report production, which we're doing on a daily basis. Those are the three income streams, if you like.
So that production of reports is the main use of the data that you have, is it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's certainly on a day-to-day basis. So it depends, you know, we might be undertaking projects that involve the use of the data as well, which are, as I say, they're more applied, if you like. But, yes, on a daily basis, we're using that data to feed into our reporting systems. So we can provide a very comprehensive baseline report on any site throughout Sussex. If somebody comes to us for whatever reason, they say they'd like to know as much information as they can, we can give them that information, and that can then inform further decisions on what studies need to be done.
So if somebody's thinking of developing a particular piece of land, no doubt that you'll be able to advise them whether they'd be interfering with a prime wildlife.
That's the key to it. When I said what we are, we're the source of the data, but we are absolutely impartial in the use of that data. And so we don't provide any advice at all. We provide the data, and it is for the client to take that data away and analyse it and make their own inference as to what they need to do next. Of course, we get people asking us for advice all the time, and we would direct them to our conservation policy team in the Sussex Wildlife Trust, who are in a position to be much less impartial, if you like, because we're... Primarily, it's because of the fact that we're providing data to not only to developers, who, you know, as you mentioned, are looking to develop a site and they need that baseline ecological data, but we're also providing it to the people that are going to be opposing that development, in just as impartial a way, and so therefore we have to remain sort of steadfastly neutral throughout the process, and so. As I say, we provide the data, and but it's up to its user to decide what to do with it.
And where does the data come from?
It can come from all manner of sources. There are, I guess, as a function of the fact that Sussex is just such a wonderful county, or counties, I should say, I suppose, for wildlife. We have very enthusiastic naturalists in the county who are actively recording all the time the species that they see. And as I said, we're the hub of that recording community. And so the people that are recording this information send it to us, and we put it into into the database. But we also pass it back to the local recording groups as well, and to national recording schemes, which are, of course, there's many of those as well for all the various different species groups. And it's particularly the county recording groups and the county recorders, as they're called, who are the acknowledged experts for each of those groups that look at that data and give it a verification, make sure that it's good data for us, that we're confident that what we're giving out is of the best quality.
How long has the record centre been going for?
I think actually putting an exact date on when the record centre started is quite difficult, because it sort of evolved. There wasn't a decision made at one particular time to start a record centre, and it's long before my time here. I think it sort of came with the introduction of the first computer to the Wildlife Trust, and when that came in, then we built a system called ESD, or we know it as ESD, which is Environmental Survey Directory, and we started collating all the ecological reports that were sent to the Wildlife Trust into a searchable form in a database. And it was from that, in a way, that the whole concept of the record centre was built. Because we started collating this information, we were in a position to start giving it back out to people. And from then, it sort of evolved into what it is today. That, as far as I'm aware, was sometime around the early 1990s.
Are there similar organisations in the other parts of the country?
Yeah, very much so. We're an accredited member of the Association of Local Environmental Record Centres, ALERC for short, and there are, I should know this, I think it's 47 other organisations in the association, and they're throughout the country. There's one or two little gaps, but almost every county has its own record centre. Not necessarily administered in the same way or constituted in the same way. Some of the local environmental record centres are hosted by local authorities, and others seem to be in museums that are, you know, they've set them up. But a number of them around the country, though, are, as we are, departments of the local wildlife trust as well. So it's almost a comprehensive national network.
I gather you've recently reached a notable milestone in your data collection.
Yes, well, as I said, we have this very large species database, and we passed the 7 million records total. It was just recently. It was in October. My job as sort of keeper, if you like, of the database is importing data and preparing data for importing. And every year we receive a very large data set from the Sussex Ornithological Society, a very active bird recording community in Sussex, and they send us an update in the early autumn every year, and that goes into our system. And it was during the import of that data set that we crossed this 7 million records threshold, which is quite exciting. As far as I'm aware, we are one, if not the biggest species database in the country. Yes, that was a big moment, obviously, when you cross the million mark, whether it's sort of 7 million or 6 million, it doesn't happen all that often.
No. And the actual seven millionth record was a goldcrest.
It was a goldcrest indeed, yes.
Is that a rare bird?
No, it's probably an infrequently seen bird, but the keen ornithologists out there will know where to find them, and so it's not common, but it's not the rarest.
No, I don't think I've ever seen one.
They are around, and in Brighton, if you've got a garden, especially at this time of the year, they become quite easy to spot. But they are, of course, our smallest bird. Absolutely tiny.
Even smaller than a wren, isn't it?
It's smaller than a wren,
oh,
yes,
right.
Indeed.
I didn't realise that.
they're very closely related to the firecrest, and they look really quite similar. And those are about equal size. But, yes, they do beat the wren very slightly for their smallness, and they really are.
If, say, you're up to 7 million records now, does that mean you've actually records of 7 million different species?
Aha, no. We've actually got, it's approximately 21,000 species in our represented in the database. So it's not bad. We're blessed in Sussex in a way, as this is one of the most biodiverse counties in the country, and so you know those species of all species groups, everything from, as we're talking about, birds right through to slugs and earthworms and wood lice, butterflies, beetles, and of course plants, flowering plants, and so. But yes, it's about 21,000 species of the 7 million.
So what you're trying to do is establish where the populations of various species are, is it?
Indeed, yes. Yeah, we've been involved in the production of various species atlases recently. There was the most recent one of which was the County Flora, published by the Sussex Botanical Recording Society. And my colleague, Andrew, produced species maps that went into that publication, which is a hugely comprehensive volume, and yeah, absolutely sort of definitive for Sussex botany. But we've also done similar things for the local butterfly conservation branch as well. They produced a lovely book of the butterflies of Sussex, and we did maps and charts for that as well. And so that's exactly the sort of thing that we're able to produce because of the comprehensiveness of the data that we've got. And so, again, as I say, we're impartial about, we don't do the analysis of the data unless we're actually asked to as part of a project, but that's exactly the sort of thing we can do. Yes, I'm currently involved in mapping all the various species of grasshopper that we have in the county for use by the National Recording Scheme.
Your publications, are they generally available to the public? Or?
Well, we don't have many publications. Well, our main one is what we call ADASTRA, which is the Review of the Recording Year in Sussex. And that's a limited print edition, and that's given out to all the attendees. We host an annual seminar for the Sussex Biological Recorders Seminar, and we give a copy of that to all our attendees, but all of the publications that we do produce are available through our website online, digital versions.
That's useful. So I'm presuming that as they're online, there's no charge for them? So.
No, not at all. No, crikey, yes. No. Well, that, going back to our reports, and I did talk about the reports that we charge for, it's also very important that people know that members of the public can get our services completely free of charge. It's only the for people using their data for commercial gain, if you like, that are charged. But, so, as much as possible, we do everything free of charge.
That's very good. On the subject of your website, what's the address of the website?
sxbrc.org.uk.
Is that Sussex BRC?
BRC, yeah. Biodiversity Record Centre.
OK, I'll repeat that in a few minutes when people have had a chance to find their pencils. Is there a phone number that they can contact you on?
Well, my phone number is 01273 497570, and if anybody wants to ring me and I'm not the person to talk to, then I'll redirect them happily.
Because even in this day and age, not everybody has access to a computer.
No, so. Of course.
Is there a way that our listeners could help with your work?
Oh, crikey. Now, there is a question. Yes, of course. What we always want is biological information, particularly records of sightings of whatever species. And if anybody's interested in a particular species group, then we're always happy to receive their records, whether it's just the birds that they've seen on the feeder in their garden or the butterflies they've seen while out for a walk in the summer. All of that information is hugely valuable to us and always very welcome. For computer fans, I would thoroughly recommend a website that's called iRecord. The easiest way to find it is to actually just Google iRecord, little I, capital R, ECORD, and you'll go straight there. And that's an online tool for biological recording. It's a national system that's set up by the Biological Record Centre in Wallingford, the national organisation. All the records that go into there are fed through to all the local record centres. Sussex is a very active user of iRecord, and that's the way I would most recommend that records come to us. But I'm always happy to take them by any other means, whether they're just handwritten in a notebook or by email or by telephone. So all is welcome.
And what's the email address?
If you go to our website, we have a contact page, so you can contact any member of the team via the website, or our general one is just info@sxbrc.org.uk, and that comes through to our main inbox.
Thanks very much, Bob. I've been talking to Bob Foreman of the Sussex Wildlife Trust about the Sussex Biodiversity Record Centre. If you'd like to find out more about the centre, you can go to their website, which is at www.sxbrc.org.uk. That's www.sxbrc.org.uk. You can contact them by email, and the email address is info@sxbrc.org.uk. And you can phone Bob on Brighton 497570. That's 01273 497570.
On 97.2 FM and online at radioreverb.com, this is Radio Reverb. And you're listening to At Home This Morning, a programme for older listeners.
The next item is a preview of the remainder of the Brighton Philharmonic Orchestra's season of Sunday afternoon concerts at the Dome. The Society's administrator, Catherine Stead, is here with me in the studio once again, and she's going to give us a preview of the three remaining concerts in the season. Over to you, Catherine.
What better way is there to spend a chilly winter's afternoon than by attending one of the Brighton Phil's enjoyable Sunday afternoon concerts at Brighton Dome, being entertained and moved by some wonderful music played by hugely talented professional musicians. We are now over halfway through our current season, which runs until the 17th of March, and our final three concerts will whisk our audience away on a musical journey around the world and back and forth through the centuries, with glorious music by the likes of Mendelssohn, Wagner, Rachmaninoff, Eric Coates, Richard Strauss, George Butterworth, and Berlioz, as well as less well-known composers such as Reinhold Glier, Emmanuel Chabrier, Hugo Alfven, Anatoly Liadov, and Arthur Honegger. On Sunday the 10th of February, we will be performing a concert of atmospheric late Romantic works, two of which are possibly the greatest pieces of music ever written for the soprano voice, which will provide a thrilling showcase for the Welsh soprano Camilla Roberts. Both Wagner's Liebestod from Tristan and Isolde and Richard Strauss's Four Last Songs contemplate those age-old questions of love and loss. Our concert is dedicated to the memory of Melanie Hornsby, who was our number two second violin for many years before sadly losing her fight with breast cancer this summer. And it will be conducted by Stephen Bell, a popular guest conductor here in Brighton and a good friend of Melanie's. The concert opens with the ethereal Prelude and Liebestod from Wagner's opera Tristan and Isolde, a symphonic study which was first performed in 1863, 2 years before the opera on which it was based was premiered, and which is seen as a watershed work in terms of harmony. Then we have the reflective Four Last Songs, written by Richard Strauss in 1948 at the ripe old age of 84. These beautifully crafted songs for soprano and orchestra are simply one of the most sublime ways for a composer to end their career. Entitled Spring, September, When Falling Asleep, and At Sunset, they were not published and performed until after the composer's death. The first three are settings of poems by Hermann Hesse, Nobel Prize winner for Literature in 1946, whilst the final song is based on a poem by Eichendorff. Our concert closes with the first symphony of Russian composer Reinhold Glier, who may not be a household name, but this work, written in 1900 when he was just 20, is full of melody and emotion and is superbly romantic. At the time of its composition, Glier was largely self-taught, but his skill in orchestration and symphonic composition is clearly evident in this glorious and melodious symphony. For our penultimate concert of the season, on Sunday the 3rd of March, our conductor laureate, Barry Wordsworth, whisks us away on an exciting musical travelogue that opens with Mendelssohn's atmospheric Hebrides Overture, otherwise known as Fingal's Cave. Then Hugo Alfven's Swedish Rhapsody No. 1 conjures up a dreamy midsummer vigil in rural Sweden, before Russian composer Anatoly Liadov displays brilliant orchestral colour and compositional skill in his tone poem The Enchanted Lake. Next, Arthur Honegger's Pacific 231 perfectly depicts a train leaving a station and gathering speed at the start of a journey. Eric Coates wrote his tune-packed London Suite in 1933, which brings pre-war London vividly to life. The third movement, the Knightsbridge March, became the theme tune for BBC Radio's In Town Tonight. We join George Butterworth for a stroll along the banks of Green Willow, a gorgeous depiction of an idyllic river scene, which is followed by our final piece, Tchaikovsky's Capriccio Italien, written after a visit to Italy, where the sounds of Italian street music on the bustling streets of Rome inspired this fantasy for orchestra. I should just mention that before this concert, on Sunday the 3rd of March, there will be a touch tour. This is a sensory introduction to the concert for blind and visually impaired concertgoers prior to the performance. Ian Brignall, the orchestra's artistic administrator, will be explaining the layout of the orchestra, introducing some of the musicians and their instruments, and describing how they will be utilised in the concert that follows. Participants will be escorted onto and guided around the stage by Dome staff, allowing them to explore the space, talk to the musicians, and familiarise themselves with some of the instruments and the sounds they make. Tickets are free of charge, but must be booked in advance through Brighton Dome Ticket Office, as places are limited to just 10. Our current season draws to a close on Sunday the 17th of March, when conductor laureate Barry Wordsworth is joined by one of Britain's most gifted pianists, Stephen Osborne, for a concert dedicated to the memory of Don Newbold, CBE, a long-standing supporter and generous sponsor of the orchestra, who passed away earlier this year at the age of 91. The concert opens with the aptly named overture Joyeuse Marche, a march which lives up to its name, by the French composer Emmanuel Chabrier. First performed in 1888, this syncopated march is full of humour and joie de vivre, and is believed to describe the progress homewards of several drunk musicians after an evening's revelry. The sprightly main theme on the oboe depicts their halting advance, whilst a second theme in the violins depicts their happy, carefree condition. Stephen Osborne will be performing Rachmaninoff's monumental Piano Concerto No. 3, one of the great romantic piano works, and certainly one of the most challenging of all the major piano concertos, which may be familiar from the 1996 film Shine, based on the life of pianist David Helfgott. Rachmaninoff wrote it in 1909 to showcase his virtuosity for his first American tour, performing it himself at its premiere. It is probably the most feared of all the piano concertos in the Romantic repertoire, demanding pianistic brilliance of the soloist. Hector Berlioz wrote his magnificent Symphonie Fantastique in 1830 as an expression of his unrequited love for the Irish actress Harriet Smithson, whom he later married. It is a hugely innovative composition, an intensely vivid work, and one of the great early romantic works that tells a story. Berlioz himself called it an episode in the life of an artist in five parts, and it includes the march to the scaffold, in which you can hear the blade of the guillotine falling, and the dream of a witch's Sabbath, where the string players use the wood of their bows to imitate the rattling of bones in a tour de force of rhythmic and orchestral virtuosity. And that, I'm afraid, is the exciting end of our final concert of the current season. Tickets for all the Brighton Philharmonic's concerts are available from the Brighton Dome Ticket Office in Church Street, and you can buy them in person over the counter or by telephone on 01273 709 709 or online at www.brightondome.org. If you go into the ticket office and pay cash, you won't have to pay any fees or admin charges. Tickets range from £12.50 to £39.50, and there's a 50% discount for students, under 18s, and anyone receiving universal credit, job seekers allowance, pension credit, or income support. You can purchase a family ticket where two children can attend for just £1 each, and anyone who is registered disabled is entitled to a free ticket for a companion. Group discounts are available if you're booking 10 or more tickets for a particular concert. Just a quick word on parking. A real incentive for those attending our concerts by car, which you may not have heard about, is heavily discounted parking at the NCP Church Street car park. The standard fee for 4 hours parking there on Sundays is normally an eye-watering £26. But our concert attendees can enjoy a reduced rate of just £6 for up to 5 hours, provided they park between the hours of 1 p.m. and 6 p.m. This rate applies to all Brighton Philharmonic concerts at the Dome, and all you need to do is collect what is called a follow-on ticket from the Dome at the concert, which you then put in the parking machine when you leave, and it reduces the cost down to just £6. Now, some people have been asking when our next free open rehearsal for children will take place, following the very successful event we put on in March, which was attended by 900 children and their families. At the moment, we don't have another open rehearsal planned, as we are working towards finding funding for a children's concert, based around the theme of folk tales and folk music, to tie in with the theme of the children's parade in the Brighton Festival in May. If, and it is a big if, we can raise the money to finance it, this would take place on Sunday the 30th of June at Brighton Dome. However, as always, our ambitious plans are subject to funding, and we are working closely with local composer James Redwood, Brighton Dome, and Brighton and Hove Music and Arts, the city's music service, in our quest to take this exciting next step in developing our education programme. So just to recap on the dates of our last three concerts at the Dome this season, these are Sundays the 10th of February, the 3rd of March and the 17th of March, with all our concerts starting at 2:45 p.m. and lasting for a couple of hours with an interval. Tickets are available from Brighton Dome Ticket Office in Church Street, telephone 01273 709 709, or you can book online at www.brightondome.org. If you would like to find out more about any of our concerts or about the orchestra, our website is www.brightonphil.org.uk, and we're also on Facebook as Brighton Phil and on Twitter as @BPO_orchestra. Our office is in George Street, Brighton, and our email address is mail@brightonphil.org.uk. Thank you for listening, and I hope that I've whetted your appetite with this preview and that you will come and join us, the Brighton Philharmonic Orchestra, at Brighton Dome one Sunday afternoon.
Thanks, Catherine. Catherine Stead, who's the Brighton Philharmonic Society's administrator, has been telling me about what's coming up in the remainder of their season of Sunday afternoon orchestral concerts at the Dome. I'll just repeat some of the contact details that she gave. Tickets for all the Brighton Philharmonic Orchestra's concerts can be obtained from the Brighton Dome Ticket Office in Church Street, whose telephone number is Brighton 709 709. That's 01273 709 709. You can also book online via their website, which is www.brightondome.org. That's www.brightondome.org. If you want to find out more details about the concerts or about the Brighton and Hove Philharmonic Society, you can go to their website, which is www.brightonphil.org.uk. And Phil there is spelt P-H-I-L. That's www.brightonphil.org.uk. Or you can telephone them on Brighton 622 900. That's 01273 622 900. Well, Chris English has been to the theatre again, and he's come to tell us about the latest show that he's seen. So, what was it, Chris?
Well, Richard, it was Abigail's Party. Now, I don't know if you can remember all those years ago, back in 1977, I think. It was actually on BBC television. And And unfortunately, I can remember seeing that original television production of Mike Leigh's play back in those far-off days of flare trousers and impossibly wide lapels. I wondered how well this acerbic masterpiece would stand the test of time some 40 or 50 years later in the very different world in which we now find ourselves. However, on entering the auditorium of the Theatre Royal and being immediately transported back in time by director Sarah Esdale's clever, yet at the same time simple set was there in front of our eyes, and also complete with appropriate walk-in music, and what became a full house took our seats, and we were indeed taken on a journey back in time, complete with those fibre optic lights, wood panelling, gin and tonic, and of course, for anybody that remembers the show, cheese and pineapple on sticks. Well, of course, the setting is important to any production. In this piece, it's the voice of Alison Steadman that has stuck in our collective minds over the years. And any actress taking on the iconic role of Beverly has to make the difficult choice of either mimicking Miss Steadman's now legendary performance or doing her own thing while sticking to Leigh's equally unforgettable script. Unless, of course, both the writer and actress who made the part her own were on hand to tweak things and provide guidance, which in this case they both were, and boy, doesn't it show. While Abigail's Party is in no way a one-woman show, the part of Beverly does require the actress playing her to have a huge personality. And here she's played magnificently, and perhaps unsurprisingly, by Jodie Prenger, a lady who first came to our attention as the 2008 winner of BBC Television's Search for a Star, who was to play Nancy in a then-new production of Oliver in the West End. And while Prenger never tries to obliterate the memories of Steadman, she totally owns the part of Beverly in her own and wondrously cheeky way. Of course, any show such as Abigail's Party needs not just a strong lead, but also, and vitally, a group of equally talented actors in the supporting roles. And here we have that in spades with Daniel Casey, who's probably best known as Sergeant Troy in the long-running TV series Midsummer Murders, taking on the vital role of Beverly's long-suffering and downtrodden estate agent husband Lawrence with total aplomb. Vicky Binns, who's known from Coronation Street and Emmerdale, and Callum Callahan, who himself is no stranger to television as the recently married, yet deeply unsure of themselves, newcomers to the neighbourhood, Angela and Tony. And finally, by no means least, Rose Keegan as Sue, whose daughter Abigail, who we actually never see or hear, is hosting the party that gives the show its name. Now, while I am in the main musical theatre-goer, this not-to-be-missed production of one of the Lifetime's groundbreaking comedy classics has awakened a new interest for me, an achievement that in no small way is wholly down to this scintillating yet blood-curdling show and its truly first-class cast and production team. The ATG production of Abigail's Party premiered in Brighton last week and is now touring the rest of the UK. Richard.
So the message appears to be that you've missed it in Brighton, but if you go on the Ambassador Theatre Group website, you'll be able to find out where else in the country it's playing and perhaps catch it at somewhere that's not too far away. Thanks very much for that, Chris. And that brings us to the end of our programme. It just remains for me, Richard Davies, to thank everyone who's taken part in the programme and to thank you for listening and to wish you all the very best. Goodbye.
At Home This Morning has been a Grey Matters production for Radio Reverb.